Working Cows Podcast, episode 150.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows podcast, and I'm here with another episode for you guys, episode 150. Thanks for your patience, and really excited today to be joined by Alan Savory. Alan joined me again to talk a little bit about what he had said on the first episode, and he made this statement that we need to save Western ranching culture, and so that piqued my interest as a guy with his background. What is his concern for Western ranching culture? What is the source of that concern? What's threatening it? And then how do we go about seeing a change in Western ranching culture? I do want to say on the front end that Alan Savory has a new book out, The End of Impossible. If you would like to support the GoFundMe or join in on what he's got going on there, with the new book, you can check out the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/150, workingcows.net/150. Also, the Jim Garish Grazing School is filled up. There is a waiting list. There is a list that you can get on to be notified about future grazing schools happening at the Cook Ranch. So if you're interested, also there will be a link to that at workingcows.net/150. But for now, I'd just like to welcome Alan Savory back to the show. Thanks for joining me on the Working Cows podcast today, Alan. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You were my guest for episode 75 of the Working Cows podcast, and through the course of that, you made a statement that caught my eye or my ear, and that was that we should be working to save this dying Western ranching culture. And I am a product of that culture, and I appreciate the culture, and I appreciate your interest in saving it. But first, I think where we should start, kind of a big picture, maybe even a global view, is, as you see it, what are the threats to the ranching industry? What are the threats to animal agriculture as you see them?
I actually don't see it that way. You know, threats to the ranching industry, threats to they are the ranching industry, and the way we raise animals is a threat to humanity. But it's also destroying the Western culture, ranching culture, as we'll come to. And the main point is nobody is to blame for this. We tend to get into blaming. It's been happening for centuries. It's the oldest problem facing us. More than 20 civilizations have failed because their societies couldn't handle the complexity of rising population and deteriorating environment. As Rebecca Costa wrote in a book, The Watchman's Rattle, and she's absolutely right. And so, but now we're facing that globally. Right now, the components in that are many, but we do know today that no nation, no family, nobody can be an island unto themselves. We are a global community. It is now a global threat, right? So if you live in the northwest of the United States and you're ranching, you're running cattle or you're forestry or whatever, there are people doing exceptionally good work, and it's really working, and the environment is improving, and they're stabilizing communities. It's wonderful. But you cannot take that same success of theirs and transfer it to New Mexico, even in the United States. And you can't transfer it to Lebanon or Afghanistan or Australia or much of Africa. The reason, as I tried to explain in a TED talk, is because we've got very different environments. But we are all in the same boat together. So people can get that, I think, quickly. If I say the rainfall of London and the rainfall of Johannesburg are about the same, but they're totally different environments. So if you do around London what many farmers and ranchers are doing in America, the faults don't show up. The land does not turn to desert. No matter what you do, no matter how badly you manage, you cannot expose bare soil between plants. You can't do it. You can poison the plants. Nature covers the vacuum. You can burn the land. Nature fills the vacuum. The soil covers quickly. Those are the environments with this humidity most of the year. Now, in New Mexico, Utah, many parts of Arizona, Texas, etc., it's not like that. And there, as I showed in the TED talk, if you do the best of practices and you do what every environmentalist and person in the world believes, and you rest the environment to let the diversity recover, the biodiversity, the opposite happens. And that is so obvious once it is pointed out and you see it, but humans never saw it for over 10,000 years. We just couldn't see it. We treated them the same. So really, the threat then in that two-thirds of the world, the greater part of the United States, etc., is coming from how we manage livestock. And that's why I say, I don't think of it like others do, that some things we are doing are threatening ranchers. No, ranchers are threatening the world, but they don't mean to.
Right.
Okay, so that, again, is why I covered that in the TED talk and showed that. And I began on the opposite end of the spectrum. I hated livestock. I only loved wildlife. That's why I began trying to study, why does land deteriorate no matter what we do? Right now, what I discovered was I had to change my damned attitude. I had to recognize that livestock are not bad. They're absolutely essential. We literally cannot save civilization now without livestock, because we've got to solve this problem biologically. It's a biological problem, right? And the world's scientists, in solving a biological problem, have to use tools. You and I can't even drink water now without using a tool. If you want to drink water, you've got to go to the nearest river and drink with your hands and your mouth. Okay, so now what tools have scientists in, say, America got to save the ranching culture? What tools have they got? They've only got three. They can use technology, and all the technology even imaginable in the world cannot stop the land deteriorating where the atmosphere, the environment is such that the humidity is erratic. And so we tried. Good people in good universities, Texas A&M, etc., developed giant machines to mimic animals, and they told, there was no science behind it, but it had the proof by authority. I am Professor so-and-so at such and such a prestigious university. I say it will work. So people accept that. They don't ask for the science. So we developed the Dixon imprinter and other large machines to break the soil surface, crumple vegetation down. In other words, mimic what animal herds did. And governments, the United States government and other governments, spent millions of dollars on these machines. It all failed because no technology imaginable can mimic an animal. Every year, over two-thirds of the world's land, roughly, it just can't be done. So what other tool do United States climatologists and scientists have? The only other tool they have is fire. And fire burns and exposes soil when it burns the vegetation and the litter. And the problem of desertification is because of bare soil. So the two tools that we humans and scientists have had for 99.9% of human existence, only technology and fire, are incapable of saving the Western ranch and culture. The ranchers have to do it themselves. It can only be done with livestock. because the only other thing available to environmentalists, ecologists, everybody, other than technology and fire, in our mainstream reductionist thinking, is to rest the land, conservation. And as I said earlier, that works wonderfully on the east and west coast. Here in Florida, where I am now, you just rest this land and it just turns to a veritable jungle of vegetation. You rest land, as experimental plots have shown, in New Mexico, and it turns to desert. It's the opposite. Why can our universities not see it when it was pointed out more than 50 years ago? It's a paradigm problem. Right. Humans just cannot see something if they're highly trained in one way of thinking, although a child can see it once it's pointed out. So now, getting back to what we started to discuss, you know, the Western ranching culture, the future of humanity, etc. The only tool that can stop global desertification and deal with the biological aspects of storing carbon and water back in the soil and deal with desertification and deal with that on a global scale is to use all the technology we have where it's appropriate, fire if it's ever appropriate, but we have to add that tool of livestock. Without livestock, we cannot solve this biological problem. Now, the whole future of every family in America, every business in America, the future of the world hangs on what I'm saying. 40 years ago, Jim Teer was a professor at A&M University. He made a strange statement to me, which I've sometimes repeated. He said, "Alan, either you are wrong, and we will not be able to dig a hole deep enough to bury you in." He said, "Or you are right, and the world will not be able to build a monument high enough." And I said, "Jim, it's not about me. It's not about our ego. It's about saving humanity. What do you think?" And he said, "I'm sitting on the fence." Well, Jim died sitting on the fence. We really need every scientist, every Nobel laureate in the world to challenge me and show where what I'm saying is wrong. And they will not do it. They've had 50 years of it, and they shoot the messenger instead of answering it. Yeah. So it's going to take people like you getting the message out in radio and every way we can until good investigative reporting starts happening. Our reporters are so sloppy. They do not follow through with things, but it will begin to happen if we can get enough information to the public, where the public starts saying, "Hey, we need some common sense and good science to start prevailing over beliefs." Yeah. Now, when we do that, the ranchers can begin to save their culture, because it's just one of the many things. Small towns are failing as droughts and floods increase and poverty and increases and immigration into cities and cross borders increases and violence and guerrilla warfare, you know, increases. All of these things increase with land degradation, including the loss of cultures, the loss of languages. We're not just losing species, we're losing languages. And there is nobody out there in the heavens doing it to us or anywhere out there. We are doing it to ourselves entirely. And you and I are doing it. Every human is, every day as we make decisions and take actions. And we do it in the way that we do, having, the idea of the aim of management and everything being to improve our lives. That's why we manage. And to improve our lives, we reduce the complexity, which is enormous, of our lives and nature and our organizations and our economies. We can't deal with that every day, so we don't think about it. We try to improve our lives by reducing that complexity to just meeting needs and desires. So you think of every rancher, every bureaucrat, every organization, every day they're taking decisions to meet needs or desires or to solve a problem. And you think of your own life, and you'll find it very hard to think of a decision you made that wasn't to meet a need, a desire, or solve a problem. And that is what is causing it. And it is literally, once you see that, it's that simple that if every rancher, because ranchers are shooting themselves in the foot, there are few that are managing holistically, but very few. The bulk of them are still opposed to change. Now, if every rancher in the world, instead of destroying their own culture as they're doing by this, just took the trouble to say, well, how could I do it differently? What would the risk be, etc.? And there's no risk at all. If it was you or me or any person who's listening, it's just a case of saying, well, if you're going to manage to improve your life, why don't we start with defining how we want our lives to be? So if you've got any rancher or ranching family, to just describe how they want their life to be based upon their culture. You said you were brought up in that culture. Right. Define that for yourself in any ranching family, and then define and describe how the land you're managing will have to be 200, 300, 400 years from now to be sustaining people in the same way of life. Forget how bad the land is now. Just describe it as it will have to be far into the future. We do that, and essentially that is what we're after. That now, just start making your decisions in that context. And that's it. And then we've got 7 checks that people can use to see that their actions are in that context. And you've got to open your mind to using livestock.
But, you know, I really appreciate that. And I guess the theologians throughout time have called it the creation mandate, that we were put here to fill the earth and subdue it. And you said we're doing it to ourselves. And I guess I would agree with that. You know, we are not fulfilling that mandate to fulfill the earth and subdue it. And part of that whole mandate is to manage things well, to steward them, the resources that have been entrusted to us. And so I really appreciate that. And I guess I am interested in your perspective on Western ranching culture. Can you, as someone who wasn't brought up in it, can you just give me a little bit of your understanding of what Western ranching culture is?
Well, to me, I wasn't brought up in it. I was brought up in Africa. But believe it or not, we sang your cowboy songs. We worshipped your guys and how well they could lasso and rope. And I grew up on a ranch in Africa. We didn't have your Western ranching culture. But the next door neighbor was a young man who'd run away from Africa. He stowed away on a ship, and he went to America. He worked on big ranches in America, and he came back. And as kids, we loved this guy because we'd go over and he could do the most incredible things with a stop whip, with a lasso. He would have us run past the house and he'd lasso a left foot or a right foot as you ran. He'd tie you in knots while you were on the ground. And then he taught me to do that. So we didn't grow up in your culture, but we loved it, your songs, your poetry and everything else. And as I've pointed out now, you go to a rodeo or anything, and half these people are athletes. They're not ranchers. And I've said that eventually the Western ranching culture will be remembered in the cowboy poetry and the athletes still keeping rodeo events going, because the small ranches and the family ranches are gradually failing. The small towns are failing as the land degradation continues. And this is tragic. And millions of cattle are in bloody feedlots, being force-fed grain. They haven't got beaks. It's just institutional stupidity. While the bulk of the United States, the land is deteriorating because there aren't enough animals on it to keep it alive. The proof is there. The science is there. Everything is there. But you cannot change the beliefs of ranchers. The cattlemen's organizations, can you name a single one that has supported me? No. Many ranchers have. It's the same as universities. Institutions have opposed what I say, but hundreds of people in universities have helped me.
Right.
Government agencies have opposed what I'm saying, but hundreds of people in government agencies helped me to develop holistic management.
Right.
Right. It is an institutional stupidity. It's a wicked problem of complex organizations. And it does not change until people in the public that you reach with radio shows and so on, until they say, hey, enough. We need to start looking at this seriously. Get beyond this institutional stupidity.
It has to come from the ground up. It has to come from the people. And some point, hopefully, in the near future, we reach a tipping point where those people, where enough people have caught on to it that the institution starts to shift. I guess, is that something that you see as a viable goal?
Yes, it's well researched. If you read Eric Ashby, Lord Eric Ashby's research, he uses, of course, many examples, British and American, and he points out that for the public to wake up and speak enough when new knowledge is involved, unfortunately, is a slow incremental progress. So we've been about 60 years now that I've been condemned and vilified for what I say by institutions. So it's been about 60 years. And if you read the research, and I do read research and heed it, it takes about 200 years. So we've got about 140 years to go. Wow. If we keep going at the pace that institutions slow it down to. As he used the example, and many know it, of the Royal Navy, when it was absolutely essential for Britain, an island, for the Navy, the Merchant Navy, the Royal Navy, when it was first discovered and proven that just taking lime juice would end scurvy, it took 200 years for them to accept that in the institution. And over a million sailors had to die. Wow. And it's no different today. Ranches and farm families are collapsing. Little town families are collapsing. We're losing cultures. And our institutions just keep blocking because of institutional egos, professional egos, etc. So, again, we know from the research that it can only be from the ground up when it's new thinking. And we just have to get the public moving quickly enough. Now, thankfully, through and helped a lot by that TED Talk going to now nearly 7 million people, we've now got about 50 locally led, locally managed, holistic management hubs on 6 continents. And I've just come from the training of the newest group of hubs coming in. Wonderful. Some of them coming, Croatia forming a hub now. And that's ordinary people beginning to just get together, including in universities, etc. Just getting together as human beings and beginning to move and not wait for political leadership or institutional leadership, because it will never come.
So in your mind, is Western ranching culture worth saving because all cultures are worth preserving, or is there something more to it than that?
No, I love the Western ranching culture. I love ranching families. I just feel it's tragic that they are their own worst enemies by not changing their organizations. If institutions won't change until the public do, and not enough ranchers have changed to force the cattlemen's organizations to change. But if you take the big fight between cattlemen's organizations and environmentalists in this country, environmentalists and vegans are winning. And it's destroying the Western ranching culture. Environmentalists and vegans cannot break that. The people who could break that quickest is the cattlemen, but they won't do it because they won't change. Let me explain that. If I was president of a cattlemen's organization, I wouldn't be, because I wouldn't be elected, because not enough ranchers are willing to change it. But if I was, what would I do? One of my first actions would be to say, wow, time out. You environmentalists chastising us for destroying land, damaging land, having too many cattle. You're right. Our land is deteriorating. But you know what? We happen to notice that the land with no cattle on it is deteriorating worse. Chaco Canyon, Utah, national parks. Use the same ones I had in the TED Talk. Experimental plots. Experimental plots put in by USDA all over the Western United States show that deterioration. Wherever the environment is brittle, it's deteriorating. All right, so you've got all these experimental plots, you've got all these protected bits of land, the destruction of habitat, biodiversity in national parks is some of the worst we have in the world. If you come to where I am in Africa, our worst land degradation is taking place in national parks. So as a cattleman, I'd be saying, yes, we acknowledge that our land is deteriorating, but we see that the land you're managing is worse. Why don't we get together and to start discussing this? That's all it would take. And only the cattlemen can do that, and they won't. There's no leadership yet in the cattlemen's industries.
Is there broad awareness of the soil as a tool for solving the issues that are facing humanity? In the vegan cultures, are they aware of the fact that soil is...
No, I'd say they are not, but it's been a worldwide ignorance. And it's hard to understand because there were people like Sir Albert Howard and others who were writing about the importance of soil before I was born. And I have a book here in my bookshelf that I value deeply. It's Sir John Russell's Soil Conditions and Plant Growth. And this copy I value deeply because it was the personal copy of Fraser Darling. I forget his first name. Anyway, Fraser Darling, who was knighted. And he spent 6 weeks with me in Africa when I was a 21-year-old. Hmm. And he gave me that personal copy and saying, Alan, don't focus on the elephants and the wildlife, focus on the soil. And I still value that. Hmm. So these are people who were mentors to me. They were writing before I was born. And only now is the soil really coming to the fore as the critical thing it is. So many people have said this over centuries. And only now, finally, are some people beginning to take it seriously. And that's great, but that's part of that slow incremental change. And yet it's so obvious that you can't live without soil. And people were aware of that in Herodotus's time, when the granary of the Roman Empire was turning to desert. Mm. So yes, it's time to move on that now.
Yeah. Do you see that we are progressing faster than the 200 years for institutional change, or are we on track with that in your mind?
We're not progressing any faster.
Yeah.
As I said, the stuff I'm talking about, I've been saying it in one way or another, essentially for about 60 years. Mm-hmm. And we haven't even got 0.0001% of the population talking about it yet.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to keep that in perspective when you live in this conversation and you're aware of a lot of the different people, not all of them by any means, but a lot of the different people on both sides who are involved in the conversation. I hear it. And so it's kind of hard to fathom that there is that many people out there that aren't thinking about these things and thinking about solving them.
Yeah, Clay, it's we constantly tend to preach to the choir. And I mentioned that in a talk I gave in London about 8 years ago, where I said, we've got to stop preaching to the choir and understand that if we do, we make slow incremental change. And it's wonderful, and I'm not against it. I'm 100% for it. But I said, even if that accelerated, and today, if the people talking about regenerative agriculture and reversing desertification and seriously addressing climate change through agriculture, which is doing so much of the damage, if we think about the people who will even listen to this program, we're talking of probably 3% of the population. Bloody lucky if it's 5%. And if we accelerated this, and 30 years from now we had 15% of the population talking about it, that would be amazing.
Yep.
And the war would be over for humanity.
Yep.
One luxury people have not got, young people, is time.
Yeah.
We have to find a way to move it quicker.
So how do we go about saving Western ranching culture? Is it education? And also the mechanics. What do properly managed livestock look like that can cause small towns to thrive again and some of those things?
Well, whether you're talking that or you're talking drug policy or terror policy or any policy, natural resource policy, anywhere in the world, it's the same issue, all right? We can do it through education. like we're talking of, the shows like this, getting the word out, slowly changing, but to get our institutions to change, as we've been talking about, we know that will take anywhere from another 50 to 150 years. We know that from research, because nothing has changed in how complexity functions in institutions. And we have to operate at scale to deal with saving the Western culture, anything. So when you operate at scale, this means through organizations. Now, to do that, the quickest way to do it, and remember that old cowboy saying that is so good, the fastest way to drive cows is slowly. So the quickest way, and then we'll be slow, is exactly what you're doing right now. You're doing the best you can. You're getting the word out to more ordinary people. Now, when enough ordinary people say, it doesn't make sense to us for policies to be developed in the way they are today, which is reductionist. They don't have to understand that fully, but if it just makes sense that policies shouldn't be reductionist, they should be holistic. The moment there's a tipping point, and it's remarkably low, of enough people in the public saying that, insisting that, then our institutions can change. Our institutions cannot change until the public is giving them permission to change. I have not been able to find a single instance anywhere in the world in history where any organization or institution has accepted new, counterintuitive, paradigm-shifting information ahead of the public. It never happens. All right, so the fastest way to save the cowboy culture and everything is just to have enough people in the public and the cattlemen's organization starting to say, we need policies to be developed holistically. Now, if you brought the top representatives of the cattlemen's industry, let's say, together, and you brought them together with the leaders of World Wildlife Fund, TNC, you know, the Nature Conservancy, all these big environmental organizations that are a threat to all wildlife at the moment because of the management, all right? So if you brought them together and you said, we're not going to discuss what to do because it'll end in argument, that's a feature of current reductionist management. It always ends in argument, whoever approaches something. So now you get them together as representatives of those two major industries, let's say. And I will promise you that if I sat down with them and said, we're not allowed to talk about fire or technology or any action, we know all humans manage to improve our lives. So now I want you to describe how you want your lives to be. Do you know it would be identical? And then if we had discussed that, and then we said, and how must the land look like? I don't give a damn if it's a national park or a private ranch or whatever. What must the land look like 500 years from now for our descendants to have a life like that? I promise you it'll be identical. Then why are they fighting? They're fighting because of reductionist management. Hmm. Now, with that agreement on a holistic context, now we say, let's discuss what we could do. And we could save the ranching culture. It would be way more, thousands more jobs for people, small towns starting to build up again, forests starting to heal again, BLM, BIA, all these big government agencies starting to heal the land again, environmentalists starting to repair wildlife habitat, not destroy it on two-thirds of the world. Everything we're wanting is available as soon as the public insist.
So I'm imagining there were a myriad of factors that led to this point, but in my own life, I've seen it. You know, we started homesteading in the late 1800s, and some of these towns grew up and thrived until about the 1980s, and then there was some serious pressure, and I think, I don't know if all of that was to blame on the economy and interest rates and all that stuff. But there was some serious pressure, and a lot of those family ranches got consolidated, and a lot of those towns, those small towns, started to dry up. And I've seen it in my own hometown, where the main street used to have way more shops on it and way more of those kinds of things on it. And so I'm wondering if the land management changed, would we see those small towns come back, or was there some sort of management? I guess my actual question is, was there some sort of management during that time when we started to see a lot of these small towns dry up? Were they operating on the capital of before the Homestead Act, and before they started to homestead these lands, were they operating on the soil, and then that soil kind of got depleted, and that contributed to some of these small towns drying up?
The answer is yes to all that, but don't think of it like that. You said, did all this start happening because the land deteriorated? No, the land deteriorated because all that started happening. In other words, it was the policies, the government policies that led. You see, that is what governments do. They see a perceived problem or see a problem. That's all that governments do. So they develop policies, and then you have laws and regulations that dictate management, and the land deteriorates. So you cannot put that right by managing the land. You cannot. Why do I say that? It's because the land is so tied to the culture. The Western ranching culture and the Western ranch lands are inseparable. You cannot manage the land without managing the culture. Now, the economy of the Western ranching lands and culture is inseparable from the land and the culture. And government was treating them in a reductionist way, ignoring that complexity and developing policies. Hmm. So it was inevitable. Now, if you want to put it right, don't try to manage the land, because you can't. The land is not manageable, separated from the culture and the economy. That's why policies have to be holistic. It's the only way we know how to bring them together. Let me give you an example. Imagine the government in those days you're talking about, the 1800s to the 1980s. Imagine every one of those governments, regardless of politics. And I promise you, this is the way they were developing policy. And I know this because I was president of a political party. That's how I learned it. All right? They would see a problem of some sort. They would bring together the best team of experts they had available to tell them how to solve that problem, and that would become the policy, and then they'd enforce it with laws, rules, regulations. That is how every government works. When I was president for a political party as an ecologist, and having spent my life working on poor land, was when I realized, oh my God, this can never work. This can never work. That's why it's not working in Germany or France or England or anywhere, or Australia. It's not working. All right. So what could we do differently? Now, just imagine you are president of a political party. All right. Now, I'm going to read out a generic holistic context. What if we were going to form an agricultural policy under you, your government, etc., and before we did anything, we said, how do the people want their lives to be? Why are we governing? And if I said, and I'm reading it out now, we want stable families living peaceful lives in prosperity and physical security while free to pursue our own spiritual or religious beliefs, adequate nutritious food and clean water, enjoying good education and health in balanced lives, with time for family, friends, and community, and leisure for cultural and other pursuits, all to be ensured for many generations to come on a foundation of regenerating soils, ethical and humane consideration for all life and biologically diverse communities on Earth's land and in her rivers, lakes, and oceans. Okay, say you've just got leaders of groups in America to define something like that. Now, don't reduce it to the problem. Develop an agricultural policy in that context. Hmm. It'll be totally different.
Right. Yeah.
Totally different. Now America would be addressing climate change, addressing the desertification of America. But what I'm talking about, and I repeat here, just cannot happen until the public insists.
Right. And I see a lot of those, you know, you've talked about some of the different environmental organizations, and I see a lot of them, at least it seems to me, their goal is to return the land to a natural state. Why would that not be enough? Or would it not be enough? I guess.
It's wonderful. So I'm dealing with that right now. I'm corresponding with one of the leading authors in the report from over 11,000 scientists to the world leaders, saying we need to treat this as a climate emergency now. And they are going to advocate certain practices for world leaders. And I've got onto them and said, well, let me give you a couple of reasons why I'm concerned about this. I said, let me just take a couple of them. One is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I said, that is because of reductionist management, the same management that is causing climate change. What are the world scientists going to recommend to world leaders to resolve that? And you know it. They have nothing to recommend. And I said, let's take another example. Let's take national parks. Everybody in the world virtually agrees with the idea of national parks are to preserve biodiversity, do what our large environmental organizations are formed to do. Nobody argues that. It's a lovely idea. All right, so why don't we take national parks and see how our management is succeeding and what 11,000 scientists might advise world leaders to do? I said, if you look at the national parks in New Mexico, Utah, and I sent photos, they're turning to desert. We're losing biodiversity. I said, if you look at them in the United Arab Emirates, and I sent pictures, it's turning to desert. And then I sent lots of pictures. If you look at the national parks around where I live in Africa, Chobe, Zambezi, Kafue, etc., all of these big national parks, every one of them, we're losing biodiversity, turning to desert. Ancient trees are toppling and falling into the rivers. It's nearly all bare ground when viewed from the air. And I said, now, what are our 11,000 scientists going to recommend to world leaders to address that? And frankly, they don't know what to do. And whatever you suggest, so if you take the national parks around us in Africa, okay, there are people saying we need more to stop poaching. We need to define the boundaries better. Need more militant action. Well, poaching has got nothing to do with that habitat destruction. It's 100% caused by management. And then you've got people saying, well, the damage is due to too many elephants. We've got to cull elephants. Well, first, there's the mistake I made and talked about in the TED Talk, where we culled 40,000 elephants and it got worse. And I said, look at the national parks in New Mexico. They've got no elephants, but you've got the same damage. You see, scientists aren't even curious. They're just ignoring this stuff. And so I said, now what else could we do? People are recommending sterilize the elephants. People are recommending translocate them, drug them and translocate them to other areas, et cetera, et cetera. And it doesn't matter what you suggest, culling, hunting, it starts an argument. So whatever any scientist suggests, you can guarantee it'll start an argument. And we have to get beyond that. Now, if you took that same situation and you got the large environmental organizations together, you got the hardcore poachers together, you got the people that live around me in the communities with the animals around these national parks, you got all of us together and you asked us not to discuss the problem or anything that we're going to do, but just everyone there agree on how we want our lives to be. You know, it's no different from the hardcore poacher to the obscenely paid person heading an environmental organization. They want better lives for their children, for themselves, better education. We want the same things. Now, talk about how that land must be, because the land in the hunting area is deteriorating, the land in the national parks is deteriorating, the land on the farms is deteriorating, on the ranches it's deteriorating. How must that land be hundreds of years from now? It would be agreement. Now we can start talking about solutions without fighting.
Yeah.
And you can take what we're discussing, lay right up to climate change. The world is confused, leaderless. We have just had COP25 in Madrid, another dismal failure. Because they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Nobody will admit that.
Yeah, it keeps coming back to get them to agree on what they want their life to be like and manage in a holistic context. And we can make a lot of progress and see a lot of the disagreements solved, I think is what I'm hearing you say.
You are, and it's absolutely correct. And why that immediately leads to change and betterness is because there's an immense amount of knowledge available in our institutions, in our ranching homes, our cattlemen's organizations, our universities, our environmental organizations. There's a massive information available, all right? And most people are good. Most people are doing their best. That's why I said when we began talking, let's get out of blaming. See, the only things we can blame is our decision-making framework, which is the same for all humans, all nations. That is causing the problem, and that involves what we manage. And if you think about what we manage, almost everything in your daily life is what we make, including space exploration vehicles. Everything is what we make. That's not complex. That's complicated. The only things we manage, actually manage, are our families, our lives, our organizations, and nature. If you think about it deeply, everything else is what we make.
Right.
Now, when we manage, then, if you hear what I said there, we're managing human organizations and nature, and they are complex,
right,
self-renewing, etc. And humans, as humans, we just never knew how to manage complexity. And that's what I accidentally discovered, not through any brilliance or anything else, but in trying to solve one problem, I suddenly realized, oh my God, we've hit a bigger issue here. And I was helped in that in the critical years in between 1980 and 1984, when I came to America as a political exile, and the far-sighted people, bureaucrats in the USDA, engaged me to put 2,000 American scientists through training over 2 years. And those 2,000 people helped enormously, and we refined that framework. And by 84, we had something that we could guarantee the results. But then institutions banned that further training.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate your time today. Is there anything that's been on your mind lately that you wanted to share? This will be out, I guess, quite a bit later from when we're recording it, but I appreciate you taking time when you're in the United States. So coordinating time zones is a little easier. And so I guess, is there anything that you've got coming up in the next few months with the Savory Institute or any of those things that are exciting to you that you would like to share?
No, just the usual. It's all from the Institute, and the strategy we're having of focusing on the world's grasslands. It's all going very, very well, but it is still incremental progress. And then I myself am trying to work with this group of 11,000 scientists and say, you guys, this is a chance to advise the world leaders on what to do. And I hope I can make some progress. I don't know.
Yeah,
but I just keep trying. We have to all keep trying because there's nothing in our way except ourselves.
Well, Alan, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for taking time to join me.
Well, thank you.
Well, very good stuff there. Really appreciate Alan taking the time again to join me, busy guy that he is. So would encourage you to check out the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/150 for links to Alan's new book, the GoFundMe page, and as well as links to the grazing school and getting on the waiting list happening at Derek Schwanebeck's place on August 25th through the 27th with Jim Garish. Other than that, I do want to give you a preview. Next week, we're talking to Zach Smith of the Stock Cropper, and I would say The most exciting thing happening in agriculture, maybe a bit of an overstatement, definitely the most exciting thing happening in row cropping and the integration of livestock. But I'm going to say the most exciting thing happening in agriculture as well. So be sure to tune in real soon for the new episode, the next episode, episode 151 of the Working Cows podcast, talking about stock cropping with Zach Smith.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.
Is that yours?
Yep, this is my youngest. The others are in school, and my wife goes and helps out at the school for a couple hours every Monday. And so I've got this guy with me. So
good. It's his future I'm worried about.
Yep, me too. And and I'm trying to manage the resources entrusted to me in such a way that he has a better piece of land than I found. So
well, you're doing the right thing.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Dave.
Yep, have a good day.